Margaret Barker was educated at Cambridge. At the completion of her education, she made a deliberate choice of a non-academic career to maximize the time that she could devote to her research and her writing. She has published 8 important books, Reconstructing the Ancient Israelite Religion, based on her research on the texts of first century Christianity. Her historical discoveries have great interest for LDS readers, and I might add for LDS faculty who have been interacting with her. She has identified the central goal of the ancient Israelite religion and the pre-exilic ritual by which men pass through the veil of the temple into the presence of God to be welcomed as his sons. Further, the Father God and his Son God were understood to be working together to bring about this result. She finds much evidence that Jesus' teachings were rooted in this older religion. Mrs. Barker has been recognized for her work by being elected president of the Society for Old Testament Study, a United Kingdom-based international association of Old Testament scholars. Her principal employment is in the Ecumenical Christian Network in Derbyshire, where she lives, and in guest lecturing. She is also a tutor and supporter and teacher for Methodist preachers. Mrs. Barker is married and has 2 children. She and her husband live in Borrowash, Derbyshire, England. We're grateful to have her with us. Mrs. Barker, please.
This morning I want to address the question, what did King Josiah reform? King Josiah was the father of King Zedekiah, and he changed the religion of Israel in 623 BC. According to the Old Testament account in 2 Kings 23, he removed all manner of idolatrous items from the temple, and he purified his kingdom of Canaanite practices. Temple vessels made for Baal, Asherah, and the host of heaven were removed. Idolatrous priests were deposed. The Asherah itself was taken from the temple and burned, and much more besides. An old law book had been discovered in the temple, and this had prompted the king to bring the religion of his kingdom into line with the requirements of that book. There could only be one temple, it stated, and so all other places of worship had to be destroyed. The law book is easily recognizable as Deuteronomy, and so King Josiah's purge is usually known as the Deuteronomic reform of the temple. 25 years after the work of King Josiah, Jerusalem was attacked by the Babylonians under King Nebuchadnezzar. And 11 years after their first attack, they returned to destroy the city and the temple. Refugees fled south, and we read in the book of Jeremiah how they would not accept the prophet's interpretation of the disaster. The prophet insisted that Jerusalem had fallen because of the sins of her people, but the refugees said it had fallen because of King Josiah. The king is not mentioned by name, but there is no doubt what the refugees had in mind. Until very recently, they said, they and their ancestors in Judah and Jerusalem had worshipped differently and had prospered. But when they changed the manner of worship, disaster had followed. They had worshipped the Queen of Heaven by offering incense, libations, and special loaves to represent her. Now, the Queen of Heaven isn't mentioned in the account of Josiah's purge, but the major item removed from the temple was the Asherah, which was dragged out and burned. Later Jewish texts describe the Asherah as a stylized tree, and Deuteronomy had forbidden any such tree or any pillar to stand beside an altar of the Lord. It was the spiritual heirs of Josiah who returned from Babylon to rebuild the temple. And their influence can be found in many of the texts we now read as the Old Testament. But these texts do not tell the whole story. The refugees who fled to Egypt were not the only ones who thought that Josiah's work had not been a reform. By surveying the texts which still survive, we can begin to piece together what it was that Josiah destroyed. Most of those texts imply that Josiah's work was a disaster. In 1897, a text was discovered in an old Cairo synagogue which described a group of covenanters in the land of Damascus. Fragments of the same text were later found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, showing that the text had been known in the time of Jesus. This Damascus document, as it is called, describes the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem as punishment for the unfaithfulness of the people. Jeremiah would have agreed with that. But it also says that the whole Second Temple era was an age of wrath. Far from restoring the true religion of Jerusalem, the people who returned from Babylon to rebuild the temple were led by false teachers who had not been chosen by God. Israel had gone astray in the hidden things. They had lost the truth. They didn't observe the true calendar or the correct forms of worship. They had corrupt priests. The Damascus Covenant group believed that they were the guardians of the true priestly traditions, and that their reward would be to return to the glory of Adam and to be resurrected. They kept careful records of their genealogies and of everything that they had done. The Book of Enoch, known as the First Book of Enoch, gives a similar account. Preserved within the fifth section of this text is an ancient and cryptic account of the history of Israel. Each period is described as a week, and so the text is known as the Apocalypse of Weeks. And in the sixth week we read, "All those who lived in the temple forsook wisdom and lost their vision, and then the temple was burned. Those who returned in the seventh week to rebuild the temple were an apostate generation, and their deeds were evil." Elsewhere, Enoch reports that those who built the second temple made impure and polluted offerings. The people who preserved the Enoch texts looked forward to the Lord destroying this impure temple and building a new and greater temple in its place. They also claimed that the words of Scripture had been altered by these godless people. On one of his heavenly journeys, the prophet Enoch saw the fragrant tree of life, which would one day be planted again in the temple, and its fruit given to the righteous. He also saw dismembered branches from the tree flourishing elsewhere in a blessed place. In another vision, Enoch saw the fragrant tree as a fiery form, the place where the Lord came when he came to paradise. Yet another text found in Egypt describes the fragrant tree as shining like the sun, and its fruits were like clusters of white grapes. Now, the book of Proverbs describes wisdom as the tree of life, and those who are devoted to her are happy. A word play which sounds like the name for Asherah. In this way, by piecing together fragments of tradition and folk memory, we can begin to glimpse what Josiah must have removed from the temple. The Asherah must have been the stylized tree of life, the symbol of wisdom, the tree with white fruit. When Moses was told to make the seven-branched lamp for the tabernacle, the menorah, he was told to make it like an almond tree, and so it was probably the original menorah that Josiah removed and destroyed. The work of Josiah was not forgotten. Even mainstream Jewish texts from well into the Christian era record that great changes took place at that time, and that the second temple was inferior to the first. The great Jewish commentary on the book of Numbers, known as the Numbers Rabbah, said that in the time of the Messiah, five things would be restored, which had been in the first temple, but not in the second. The fire, the ark, the menorah, the spirit, and the cherubim. In other words, the true temple which the Messiah would restore would be the first temple, the one that Josiah had purged. The mystery here is the menorah. There had been a seven-branch candlestick in the second temple, but it cannot have been the true menorah if this was deemed to be missing. The Babylonian Talmud, which is another important Jewish text, records that Josiah had hidden away the ark and the anointing oil and the jar of manna and Aaron's rod. Most of these items, the ark, the cherubim, the oil, the manna, Aaron's rod, had been kept in the Holy of Holies of the temple, to which only the high priests had access. In other words, Josiah's changes concerned the high priests, and they were changes at the very heart of the temple. Josiah had not been the first king who attempted to change the religion of Israel and Judah. King Hezekiah, in whose time Isaiah was a prophet in Jerusalem, removed hilltop places of worship, destroyed sacred pillars, and broke down the Asherah. When envoys from Assyria came to demoralize the people of Jerusalem before they attacked the city, they said that their God would no longer protect them because their king had been destroying his places of worship. So Hezekiah was not seen by his contemporaries as a reformer. Hezekiah's predecessor, King Ahaz, had followed the older religion. He had burned incense at the hilltop shrines and under sacred trees. He'd even sacrificed his son. And yet Isaiah has no word of condemnation for him on these matters. He only rebuked him for his lack of faith in the Lord when Jerusalem was threatened by enemies. Isaiah, it would seem, favoured the older ways. He spoke of the great tree which had been cut down, but still preserved the holy seed in its stump. And he compared the servant of the Lord to a branch of the menorah, which had been damaged, but its light had not gone out. Almost everything that Josiah swept away can be matched in the religion of the patriarchs Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They had built shrines all over the land wherever the Lord had appeared to them. They'd offered sacrifices under great trees. They set up pillars to mark holy places. In the Old Testament as we know it, the patriarchs before the time of Moses and the kings after him followed the very religion which Deuteronomy condemned and Josiah purged. The custom of child sacrifice, which Josiah abolished, had been required in the oldest of the Hebrew law codes, and only the later modifications permitted a substitute offering of silver shekels or a Levite for temple service. This particular change is reflected in the way the story of Abraham and Isaac is told in our Old Testament. Abraham had thought that the sacrifice of his son was necessary, but the Lord told him that a substitute should be offered. Another version of this story survived for centuries, and this story said that Isaac had actually been sacrificed and then resurrected. This version of the story appears in both Jewish and Christian sources. It appears in the Jewish Targums and in the early Christian writings of Barnabas and Clement, an early bishop of Rome. It is also probably implied in the letter to the Hebrews and the letter of James in the New Testament. And we must not forget that the sacrifice of the Son lies at the heart of Christianity. And the emphasis of the letter to the Hebrews is that, in the case of Jesus, no substitute was offered. This shows that memories of the older religion and its stories survived for centuries, even though they do not appear in the biblical texts. Abraham, too, had paid his tithe to Melchizedek, the priest-king of Jerusalem. And so the Melchizedek priesthood must have been part of the older religion. A fragmented text about Melchizedek was found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Melchizedek was divine, the Messiah, expected to return at just the time when Jesus began his ministry. And Melchizedek would make the final great atonement. A damaged portion of the text seems to mention teachers who have been kept hidden and secret. Nothing else of the Melchizedek tradition survives in the biblical texts apart from one line in Psalm 110, And so we have to ask, who preserved these Melchizedek traditions which we find among the Dead Sea Scrolls? One way to reconstruct the religion of Jerusalem before Josiah is to note how many of the practices forbidden by Deuteronomy are permitted elsewhere in the Old Testament. Deuteronomy, for example, denies that any vision of God was seen when the law was given. You saw no form, only a voice was heard, Deuteronomy chapter 4. And yet the account in Exodus says that Moses went up the mountain with the leaders and elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel, Exodus 24. Isaiah had seen the Lord high and lifted up, Isaiah chapter 6. The vision of God must have been part of the older faith. And in these other texts, there are several accounts of the Lord emerging from his holy place, appearing with his angels, prayers for the Lord to shine upon his people. Deuteronomy condemns any regard for the angels as the host of heaven, the angels who are represented by the stars, even though the most ancient title for the Lord was the Lord of hosts. So the heavenly angels must have been part of the older faith. Deuteronomy also taught that the law of Moses was to be the wisdom of the chosen people, that the law would make them wise. The book of Proverbs, on the other hand, says it was wisdom herself who makes disciples wise. Wisdom must have been part of the older faith. All these three, and there are several more, visions of the Lord, the angels, wisdom, feature in the accounts of Josiah's purge. Enoch said that the priests in the temple lost their vision because they abandoned wisdom. The account in 2 Kings 23 describes how the houses which belonged to the prostitutes in the temple were destroyed. Now, this is a strange thing to find in a temple, but exactly the same Hebrew letters can be read to mean holy ones or angels. So what Josiah probably destroyed were the shrines for the angels, just as he destroyed the Asherah, which was the symbol of wisdom, the queen of heaven. Isaiah had seen the Lord among the angels. He said he'd seen the Lord of hosts in the temple. But Deuteronomy never mentions angels. Another way to reconstruct the older faith is to compare certain Old Testament texts with parallel accounts elsewhere. To take one example, let us compare the account of creation in Genesis chapter 1 with other accounts in ancient texts. According to Genesis, on day 1, God said, "Let there be light," and then separated light from darkness. Now, the pattern of temple symbolism is that the 6 days of creation correspond to the 6 days by which Moses erected the tabernacle. Day 1 corresponds to the Holy of Holies, the second day to the veil of the tabernacle, the third day to the table for the showbread, and so forth. And so whatever we read about day 1 will have been a secret of the Holy of Holies, accessible only to the high priests. In Genesis, we are told nothing except that God created light and separated it from darkness. In the book of Jubilees, however, another text found among the Dead Sea Scrolls and preserved by the ancient church in Ethiopia, there is a fuller account of day 1 and thus of the Holy of Holies. On day 1, the Lord created the angel spirits who serve before him, and the ranks of these angels are listed. A similar list appears in the song of the three young men in the fiery furnace, which is found in the Greek version of Daniel chapter 3, but not in the Hebrew. The young men call on all creation to praise the Lord, beginning with a detailed account of the angels described as the works of day 1. It's not until almost halfway through their song that they call on the works of the visible creation to offer praise. The readers of the Book of Jubilees and the readers of the Greek Daniel knew that the angels had been the work of day 1, but we do not learn this from the Hebrew Genesis. It comes as no surprise, though, because the angels were located in the Holy of Holies, which is where Isaiah saw the heavenly host. Presumably, knowledge of the angels had been a part of what Josiah sought to eliminate. Deuteronomy doesn't mention angels. Deuteronomy does, however, warn against the secret things, presumably the knowledge of the Holy of Holies. the secret things belong to the Lord our God, Deuteronomy 29. Deuteronomy doesn't deny that such secret things exist, but says that all that is necessary is to obey the law and keep the revealed commandments, the affairs of the Holy of Holies, were the exclusive preserve of the high priests. They alone had charge of the affairs of the altar and the Holy of Holies. They alone were permitted to look at the furnishings of the tabernacle. The great angels had been known as the sons of God. It is ironical that in the first of the two great poems appended to the book of Deuteronomy, we are given the clearest picture of these sons of God. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, he fixed the bounds of the people according to the number of the sons of God, Deuteronomy 32. There was one guardian angel for each nation. The poem goes on to say that Jacob was allotted to the Lord. In other words, that the Lord, the God of Israel, was the son of God Most High. The older religion had not been a monotheism in the way that that word is usually understood today. The Lord, the Son of God, had been the angel of Israel, or as Isaiah said, the Holy One of Israel, since the Holy One is an angel. The Lord, as the Son of God Most High, became a sensitive matter, and so there were two versions of this text in Hebrew. The Masoretic text, as we call it, on which most English translations are based, doesn't have sons of God at this point, but instead has sons of Israel, giving he fixed the bounds of the people according to the number of the sons of Israel. The Old Greek text, however, and the Hebrew found among the Dead Sea Scrolls both have sons of God, showing that God Most High apportioned the nations among his sons, and that the Lord, the God of Israel, was the Son of God Most High. The early Christians read the Old Testament in this way. Whenever the Lord appeared, for example, to Abraham, they recognized that it was an appearance of the second person of the Trinity, the Messiah, the Son of God. Once we know that the sons of God were an important part to the first temple religion, other Old Testament texts begin to appear in their original setting. The Holy of Holies was the place of the angels, and so the rituals of the Holy of Holies must have been associated with the world of the angels. According to the books of Chronicles, there was in the Holy of Holies a golden throne in the form of a chariot of cherubim, concealed behind the veil of the temple. But the account in 1 Kings, influenced by the Deuteronomists, mentions neither the chariot throne nor the veil. So these must have been important items in the older religion. You will recall that the cherubim had been in the first temple, but not in the second, but were to be restored in the time of the Messiah. The book of Chronicles also reveals that when Solomon was made king, he sat on this chariot throne, described as the throne of the Lord, and when he was enthroned, the people worshipped him, 1 Chronicles 29. The people worshipped the Lord, the king, is a literal translation of verse 20. The king, in some way, was the Lord. He was enthroned in the Holy of Holies, and he was the Lord with his people. According to Isaiah, he was known as Emmanuel, God with us. A human being who entered the Holy of Holies became an angel. Isaiah records the song of the angels in the Holy of Holies as the new angel is born as the Son of God. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. The most complete picture of the first temple religion has been preserved in the Enoch texts. Ancient leaders such as Noah and Moses became angels while they still lived on earth. Enoch was himself a high priest figure who entered the Holy of Holies and was transformed into an angel when he stood before the throne and was anointed and clothed by the archangel Michael. Quoting from one of these Enoch texts, "He anointed me and he clothed me, and the appearance of that oil was greater than the greatest light. It is like sweet dew, its fragrance is myrrh, it is like the rays of the glittering sun. And I looked at myself, and I had become like one of the glorious ones." You'll recall that the anointing oil had also disappeared in the time of Josiah, that there is almost nothing about Enoch in the Hebrew Bible, even though he was a major figure among the Dead Sea Scrolls. All the Enoch visions of the Holy of Holies must have been memories of the ancient rituals. The high priest taking petitions into the presence of God, the high priest looking out from the Holy of Holies, seeing all history spread before him so that he knew the future, the blood of the righteous one being offered before the judgment seat. This latter must have been a memory of the ancient rite of atonement, when the blood of the royal high priest was offered in the Holy of Holies, presumably using an animal substitute. Daniel's vision of the man ascending with clouds to the Ancient of Days, Daniel chapter 7, says literally, he was offered before him, and then he was given dominion. Atonement is completely missing from Deuteronomy. The festival calendar in Deuteronomy 16 describes Passover, Pentecost, tabernacles, but no Day of Atonement. The final form of the Pentateuch, compiled under the influence of Josiah's party, denies that atonement was even possible. After Israel had sinned and made the golden calf, Moses went back up the mountain to offer himself as an atonement for their sin. The Lord said to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, him will I blot from my book," Exodus 32. Why had Moses thought that his self-sacrifice could have been an atonement for sin? Presumably, there had once been a time when such things were thought possible. The older faith didn't disappear. The people who preserved the Enoch traditions kept the older faith. The community of the Damascus Covenant seemed to have kept the older faith. Those who wrote the Qumran Melchizedek text even knew the date at which the older faith would be restored, and it emerged as the framework of early Christianity. Jesus was proclaimed in the letter to the Hebrews as Melchizedek, and John in his vision recorded in the book of Revelation that the ark had been seen in the temple. Remnants of the older faith survived in many places, preserved by the descendants of those who fled from Josiah's purge. There was the mysterious sons of Rechab, whose story was told in the history of the Rechabites. Beneath the layers of fantasy and folktale in this widely known ancient text, we glimpse a group who described themselves as angels, who had fled from Jerusalem just after the time of Josiah. Angels had released them from prison, and they'd escaped to the desert and crossed a great sea to a paradise land of fruit trees, honey, and abundant water. Angels continued to tell them about events in their former world, and so they knew about the life of Jesus. Zosimus, who visited the Rechabites, brought back stone tablets with an account of them. Now, Rechab is a very interesting name because it can also mean a chariot. And so the angel sons of Rechab might have been devotees of the chariot thrown in the temple who fled from Jerusalem after Josiah's purge and settled somewhere across a great sea. Aramaic papyri found at Yeb in the south of Egypt describe a group who worshipped Yahuwah, another form of the Hebrew name for the Lord, but they had other divine names with feminine forms. None of the names was Egyptian, so they were not the result of local syncretism. But they had built themselves a temple and they had a priesthood, so they did not accept that there could be only one temple in Jerusalem. Originally, they had made no blood sacrifices, just offerings of wine, incense, and cereals, like the refugees who fled to Egypt with Jeremiah. Isaiah had prophesied that there would be an altar for the Lord in the midst of Egypt, Isaiah 19, and five cities speaking the language of Canaan and worshipping the Lord of hosts. To the south of Yeb, in Ethiopia, there are the Kemant, another people who have preserved the older faith. They observe the Sabbath and the Old Testament food laws. They worship one God who can appear in human form, whom they name Adara, which is not unlike the Hebrew word for the glorious one. They acknowledge seven great angels and they expect the day of judgment. They know of Abraham and of Adam. They set up stone pillars and anoint them. And the holy men pray to Adara by sacred trees. Some of the holy men have been taken up to heaven and never seen again. There is also the tradition that the ark was taken to Ethiopia before the destruction of the first temple. Christian monks in the Lake Tana monastery still tell of the time before their people became Christian and how they kept their ark for many centuries until it was taken away to Aksum. In western China, on the border with the Tibet, are the Chiang Min, a people whose way of life was recorded at the beginning of the last century by a Christian missionary. Their religion was identified as that of the Old Testament before Josiah's purge. That missionary's son is Professor Tom Torrance, the distinguished theologian in the University of Edinburgh, Scotland, and he wrote this: "I am convinced of my father's main thesis. The religious observances of the Chiang seem to derive from a period in Israel's history before the centralization of the worship had been carried out in Jerusalem and when high place worship was still practiced. The Chiang Min worship on a high place with an altar of unhewn stones, a sacred tree behind the altar, a white stone set between them. God, whom they call Abba Malak, came to his people through the sacred tree. They had remembered that Abba meant father, but they had lost the meaning of Malak, which is clearly Hebrew for angel. They had a sacred rod carried by their priests in the form of a snake twisting around a pole, and they called their faith the white religion. The religion of Abraham was long remembered as distinct from that of the Jews who also had the teachings of Moses. The Quran asks, do you claim that Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob, and the tribes were Jews or Christians? This religion of Abraham must have been the older faith before Josiah and the Deuteronomists made Moses the more important figure. The earliest account of the life of Muhammad, written in the middle of the 8th century AD, and so only about 100 years after the time of Muhammad. Before the prophet appeared, it says, four good men set out to seek the religion of their father Abraham, which they believed their people had corrupted. They accepted neither Judaism nor Christianity, but sought the Hanifiya, who had kept the faith of Abraham. One of them went as far as Syria, where a Christian monk told him there was nobody left who kept the faith of Abraham, but a prophet would soon appear. On the southwest coast of India, there are also the so-called Black Jews, a group who claim to have travelled to India after the destruction of the temple. There seem to have been trading links between Palestine and southern India in the time of the first temple, and early Christian writings say that the apostles Thomas and Bartholomew went to India as missionaries. Pantinus, who became head of the Christian Academy in Alexandria in the late 2nd century, had in his younger days travelled as a missionary to India. And he said that he found there the Gospel of Matthew in Hebrew, showing that Bartholomew had preached to a Jewish community in India. Perhaps the most compelling evidence for large numbers of people leaving Jerusalem after Josiah's purge is to be found in a Jewish text, the Jerusalem Talmud, a compendium of teachings and traditions compiled about 400 AD. It describes how a large number of young priests sided with Nebuchadnezzar against Jerusalem, and then went to Arabia, where they were denied hospitality by the family of Ishmael. This is presented in the Talmud as the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy that those who had been in the Forest of Lebanon, that is, the temple complex known as the House of the Forest of Lebanon, they had gone and found themselves in the thickets of Arabia. And Jeremiah himself records that King Zedekiah was more afraid of the people who had gone to the Babylonians than he was of the Babylonians themselves. This is Jeremiah chapter 38. The priests who supported the Babylonians against Jerusalem must have been those who could not accept what had been done in the temple by Josiah. What they took with them to Arabia must have been the faith of the first temple, the religion which Josiah sought to purge. Now, we can never know for certain what it was that Josiah purged or why he did it. No actual text or records survive from that period. But even the stories as they have come down to us in various sources show that this time of major upheaval was never forgotten. 1,000 years after the events themselves, even mainstream Jewish texts remembered that the temple had been drastically changed, that large numbers of people left the land at that time, and that the true temple would only be restored in the time of the Messiah. Thank you.